This is T. Morris. I am the uber nemesis of all podcast authors. And if you're wondering what I'm talking about, take a listen to the Survival Guide to Writing Fantasy recorded live at Balticon. You can find this episode at tmorris.com/blog. And while you are listening to Murder at Avedon Hill, episode 23, I am watching you, P.G. Holyfield. I'm always watching you.
Welcome to the podcast presentation of Murder at Avedon Hill, The Chronicles of Aramis Cragan, written and produced by P.G. Holyfield. Hey everyone, and welcome back. Thanks for your patience once again. I've had a very busy 2 weeks, and I'm actually quite happy I was able to finish the episode today. I'll talk more about what's been going on after the chapter. This week marks the return of Philippa Ballantyne as Greta's mother, Gloria Platt. Chasing the Bard is getting really good, and I've had a lot of fun voicing Oberon, the King of the Fae. If you haven't checked it out, please do at chasingthebard.com. In the last episode, Aramis and Aaron discovered one of the secrets of the Avedon family, namely the condition of Lord Avedon's son, Edvard. This week, more secrets will be revealed, so let's get to them. Stay tuned after the episode for more information on the contest I've got going on and about the live reading I mentioned a few weeks ago. But now, it's time. And now, episode 23 of Murder at Avedon Hill.
Chapter 22, The Platt Family Secret. The Icon of Doppin, the Child of Trickery.
I know myself, even as I am pulled from my birth mother.
Ah, but can you speak?
What?
Can you talk? I'd like to see the look on your ma's face if you said, put me back in.
Doppin and Lem, from the play, Balak Poe.
Aramis led Aaron to the first floor of the manor. They reached Greta's office without meeting any guards along the way. Aramis entered the office door and walked around the desk, motioning for Aaron to light a lamp sitting on a ledge by the door. Aaron silently did as he was asked, and then carried the oil lamp over to the desk where Aramis was now sitting. Aramis's slumped shoulders and heavy eyes made him appear weakened, but it wasn't from the injury he had sustained a short while before.
Aaron, do you think you can find the kitchens from here?
Do you need food?
Yes, whatever you can find. I will stay here.
Aramis wanted to lay his head down on Greta's desk, but refused to allow himself that luxury. The monk did not completely understand why he was so dependent on food. He had dedicated nearly his entire life to the land. Cairn had provided him with powers that, in turn, had allowed him to better serve the land. During that time, Aramis had survived many periods of fasting, going days without food and water. But now the monk could barely go a psyche without sustenance, and the exertions of that evening had left him spent. In an attempt to get his mind off his hunger, Aramis again considered the mystery surrounding the Avedon family. It would be logical to assume that Edvard Avedon killed Greta Platt. There are a myriad of reasons. He had the motivation, hunger, the opportunity, knowledge of the secret passages, and the method to train Greta without leaving much in the way of blood at the scene. We know Greta was not killed by a moonbeast, since Greta's corpse was relatively undamaged by her attacker other than the bite marks on her neck. Almost as important is how Lord Avedon continues to act. He fears for more than just his son. Unless I am mistaken, his fear is more about his family's way of life. Why had Greta been so important to him? Obviously, she was his confidant, his advisor, his business partner in a lot of respects. But there is something more. There has to be. What is the true nature of the relationship between the Avedon and Platt families? He looked at the office around him. The secret has to be here, somewhere. It was some time before Aaron returned to Greta Platt's office, bread and dried meats in hand. He found Aramis surrounded by the books and papers he had removed from shelves and placed neatly on the floor. Aramis stared at the walls, as if willing them to reveal some hidden bit of information. "Redecorating?" Aaron quipped as he handed Aramis a piece of bread. The monk ignored the jest. "No hidden doors, no secret compartments. This room does not connect to anything, except the hall. I even moved the desk and searched the floor." Aramis bit down on some dried beef. "Help me return the books to their places on the shelves. I hope for better luck down the hall." Aaron recalled that Greta had moved to this office when she began her work as house mistress, claiming that her mother's office was too cramped for her.
"Down the hall, you mean Gloria's office?"
"Yes." A short time later, Aramis and Aaron walked towards the housemistress's former office, located near the kitchens. They passed two guards along the way, both of whom nodded, but otherwise ignored their presence.
"Lord Avedon must have passed along word that we were here. They didn't stop me when I went to the kitchens either."
Aramis tried the door and found it to be locked. He knew he could unlock it easily, but decided to test Aaron.
"Ah, something for you to do. Please open the door, and I will make sure the guards we just passed do not find the need to investigate what we are doing."
Aaron unsuccessfully attempted to conceal a smirk.
"Aye, master."
Aramis smiled and backtracked to the end of the short hallway. He peered around the corner at the hall guard. He was still leaning against a wall, doing his best to stay awake in what was now the middle of the night. The monk quietly shuffled back to Aaron, who was still working on the door's lock.
Aramis sighed.
"Your mother gave you that lockpick set, did she not?"
"Yes, you know she did."
"And you know it saved your mother's life on more than one occasion."
Aaron did not pause from his work.
"Yes, so I've heard. No one bothers to explain the details, but I've been told this lockpick set was her favorite toy growing up."
Aramis, chewing on what was left of the bread Aaron had brought to him, shook his head.
"Toy? Those pieces of metal you're holding were so important to your mother, so a part of who she was, that she used to carry them tied to her waist underneath her undergarments."
He paused for a moment, studying Aaron as he continued to work on the lock.
"By the age of 8, your mother could unlock every door and chest at Castle Penn in the time it took me to walk to the corner of this hall and back."
Drona Two-Blade is shuddering in his crypt as we speak. Drona Two-Blade had been the ironic advisor to King Destra of Yu, while Aramis Cragan had served as advisor to Prince Wren, King Destra's youngest son and Aaron's grandfather. Before joining the Ironic Order, Drona Two-Blade had spent much of his youth in a completely different line of work. As a result, the children and grandchildren of King Destra had what some might consider unorthodox training. Aramis continued his whispered harangue.
"Your current instructors at Castle Penn would not be qualified to teach students how to muck horse stalls at Thorn's Way."
Aaron heard the click
of the door lock and let out a satisfied sigh. I hope not. The priests of Cairn did not send stable hands to school us. Disregarding his mentor's snort, Aaron stood and entered the room. The office formerly used by the housemistress of Avedon Manor was much larger than Greta's office, but Aaron immediately discerned why Greta moved her daily activities to the room down the hall. Aaron had no doubts that the Platt women that had all held the title of housemistress of Avedon Manor were all very thorough at their job. If appearances were truth, nothing that had ever been written or carried into this room had ever been discarded. One might assume the walls were made of paper and not of stone and wood panels. Stacks of parchments, papers, scrolls, and bound texts encircled the room. Bookcases lined most of the walls, but the spaces in between were filled with piles of papers and texts that climbed the walls to the ceiling. Only after their eyes adjusted to the darkness did both men see the strings and ribbons that acted as a sort of net against some of the weight that threatened to bring the room down on top of them. Irma spotted a small lamp hanging from the ceiling above the main desk in the office. He motioned to Aaron, and moments later they began searching the well-lit room. What exactly are we looking for, Aramis?
I believe these shelves hold much of the same information that we found in Greta's office, only extending back for centuries. While we would learn much from the information in this room, we do not have the time to spend in that endeavor. But there is something else, something important we are missing. There is a reason Lord Avedon is so lost without Greta. While the secrets of Avedon Manor might be sitting here in the open, just waiting for us to find them. Aramis left the statement unfinished.
Aaron implicitly understood that Aramis referred to some sort of secret room or hidden panels within the office. Aaron began studying the shelves, lining the large percentage of the four walls of the room, starting with the wall opposite the office door. Aaron looked for any books that appeared out of place. He looked for hinges, levers, anything that could be pushed or moved in such a way that it might uncover a door. What Aramis had done in Greta's office by emptying the bookcases was not an option for them here. Aaron didn't know how to even attempt it without chancing a collapse of the walls around them. If this room had a secret door, it had to be easy to access once the trigger was found. After an initial scan of the room, Aaron concentrated on the ceiling, at the edges where the walls and ceiling met. All of the bookcases on the far wall, the wall opposite the door, were capped with a long, thin piece of oak that ran across the entire length of the wall. Aaron discerned no cracks in that wood molding, which might indicate a door. While architecturally it would make sense to build a secret room behind the wall opposite the office's entrance, Aaron turned his attention to the northern wall, the wall to the left of the office door. The eastern edge of the northern wall had an additional bookcase that met the bookcases that lined the eastern wall. There was a crack in the wood along the ceiling where the bookcase on the northern wall met the bookcase lining the eastern wall, but no evidence of a door. Aaron began studying the books and parchments on the northern wall's single bookcase. Primarily, there were boxes and crates filled with documents on this wall. He began pulling and pushing on the boxes, moving them from side to side as well, looking for anything that might act as a lever or a trigger. He then began working on the books not in boxes and then moved to the scrolls that were held in place by ribbons attached to the shelf itself. Again, he found nothing. Unswayed, Aaron stepped back and studied the wall as a whole, concentrating on the section of wall to the left of the northern wall's bookcase, the section of wall that created a corner when it ran up against the western wall. This area, just wider than Aaron's shoulders, was lined from floor to ceiling. A few boxes, but mostly papers stacked on top of each other. The same strings seen throughout the room seemed to be holding the tower of papers and loosely bound texts in place. But in this case, the strings, beginning at the hooks protruding from the ceiling,
were not as taut as their counterparts throughout the room. From all appearances, there was little keeping the tower, the flying buttress of paper both bound and unbound, upright. Since the entire room produced the illusion that the walls were leaning out over the office like some large animal hovering over its prey, an avalanche of documents should have taken place long ago. There. Aramis had been looking in and around the large desk in the center of the room, searching for levers or secret drawers. Hearing Aaron, the monk raised his head and saw his young friend poking and prodding what appeared to be the most perilous area of the entire room. But nothing fell. A few moments later, Aaron pushed on the spine of a large book that had strange symbols on it, and after a mechanical click, a 6-hands-width-wide section of wall from floor to ceiling rolled back, leaving a small opening for them to enter. Aramis looked at the papers and books that should have fallen on top of them. Ingenious. All of these papers and books and boxes, they all glued together against the wall so they wouldn't fall. How did you know? Aaron smiled and pointed out the strings that were still in their place, extending from ceiling to floor, holding nothing. The strings, they were not taut, not like the others around the room. I realized the stacks here were being held to the wall by some other means. Aramis patted Aaron on the shoulder. There is intelligence in there. I am so proud. Aaron smirked. What do those symbols mean? I don't recognize them. He pointed to the binding that had triggered the secret door. Aramis studied the symbols. He recognized them as early Inaran icons, sometimes found on the walls of caves where the earliest barbarians of the north had lived. That is the symbol of Dopin, the trickster. Yes, and this other symbol here means path. It makes sense. Dopin's way. Let us see what a secret door that invokes the name of one who extends across all boundaries has hidden behind it. Aaron had not heard that phrase before. What do you mean by that? Aramis paused before entering the passage. We have talked before about the children of Aj and how they have walked the land from time to time, sometimes to help their father's creation, and other times to perform their sacred duties, no matter how destructive they may be to our world. Aaron nodded as Aramis continued. We have covered as well how Aj was forced to take steps to prevent his children from inadvertently destroying his land. The constraints of the children. For eons, Aj's children could leave the immortal plane and enter our world. They could pose as one from any race or as any intelligent creature in the cases of Ursula and Trake. Or they could simply walk Cairn in their immortal form, causing all manner of death and destruction at a whim. But after the constraints had been laid down by Aj on his children, they could thereafter only enter this world under certain conditions. Aaron continued his thought. They would live in this world as mortals, with no knowledge of their true identity. They would be born as we are, live as we live, and die as we do. Unless they receive their epiphany. Aaron continued on the track of Aramis's interjection. If one of the other children, or if Aj himself wills it, an avatar will most likely come to understand his own true nature. This is called their epiphany. Once this occurs, the avatar is still mortal, but with all the knowledge and legend says some of the powers of their immortal self. Aaron thought for a moment. The one who extends across all boundaries. I still don't understand why Dopin is called that.
Dopin is most often the one that causes an avatar to learn his true nature, and mostly for Dopin's own reasons. Legend states that Dopin is unaffected by some of the constraints, namely the restriction that keeps the knowledge of his true nature hidden from him. Even at birth, Dopin is said to have full knowledge of himself.
Aaron completed the lesson for Aramis. And as a result, the boundary that is crossed when the epiphany occurs, that does not hold sway for Dopin. And that is why he is sometimes called the one who extends across all boundaries. Aramis nodded once and proceeded through the secret door, lamp in hand. After proceeding down a short passage, they found themselves in a small alcove, smaller even than the watchroom from earlier that night. The room was completely empty, save for a small desk against the opposite wall of the alcove. Five large ledgers rested on the desk, stacked one on top of the other. Aramis approached, looked around to make sure they hadn't missed anything else in the room, and then opened the book that rested on top of the stack. A ledger, large numbers listed in columns. Could these columns represent receipts and payments? Aramis rubbed his forehead. This makes no sense. The numbers listed here are far more than is collected yearly through tolls for using the Olviarin Pass, or for any tariffs on goods traveling through the town. Aaron worked his way around Aramis to look at the information for himself. What are those? T.B. Talibor, H. Hemming, S.T. Sarah Tremaine, C. Akaj, L. A. Could be initials of some of the townspeople. If I have these columns correct, these might represent payments made to them. Are you serious? Look at the numbers next to... Who would that be? Talik? Hemming? They could live off of one of these payments for a year. And there are multiple entries for each of them. If this is accurate... There are some very rich people here in Avedon Hill. Aramis concentrated on what he thought might be the income side of the ledger. There were codes here as well, more likely for accumulated amounts of tolls and tariffs that were detailed in some of the documents they had seen in Greta's office. But there were other abbreviations that Aramis did not understand at all. And these were tied to the ledger entries with the largest amounts, undocumented in any of the paperwork Aramis had seen in Greta's office. Oh my. All the pieces shifted slightly, falling into place. The unchanging population of the town, the generations of families that had remained in Avedon Hill, the quiet place that by all accounts should be a thriving town, at the least. It was all by design. Aramis slammed the ledger shut. He could tell, after looking at just a few pages, that the five tomes on the table represented at least the last 300 years of Avedon Hill's history. Come, Aaron, we have a grieving mother to visit.
You certainly realize how late it is.
Gloria Platt stood, arms crossed, barring the doorway to her daughter's home. Her eyes glared, but she still used that calm, soothing voice. I gave you a promise that I would find out what happened to your daughter and bring her back to you for a proper burial. I plan to keep that promise. But right now, you need to let us in so we can talk. Aramis had his hand on the door, preventing her from closing it on them. Gloria Platt had abandoned her black dress for one of dark blue, but she still wore the black mourning bonnet from the day before. Aramis could also see evidence that Gloria Platt had been sitting in front of the fire, drinking a hot beverage. Besides, it does not appear that you were sleeping. Gloria looked at both men for a moment.
You may come in, Sir Aramis. Your companion will wait for you outside.
Aramis, ignoring the ire he sensed from the prince, entered the Platt home and closed the door behind him. Gloria motioned to a chair that faced the one she sat down in.
You made it into the manor through the catacombs?
Aramis nodded. Yes, thanks to your help.
And have you discovered much tonight, Advisor Cragen?
Yes, as you knew I would.
Gloria Platt covered her arms with a light blanket. The flames from the fireplace were reflected in Gloria's eyes.
Lord Avedon has done his best to keep me in the dark as to what has happened and what is happening at the manor. I knew you were the one person who could help me learn what he is hiding.
Aramis considered her statements. We have made certain promises to Lord Avedon in this matter. You can rest assured that your suspicions were well warranted, and that we are much further down the path of discovery due to your help. I cannot tell you what we have learned, but understand, there is a good chance of further attacks on the townspeople here. I would suggest taking every precaution you can, lady.
You cannot tell me? I'm not accustomed to hearing that phrase, much less accepting it.
Gloria's face changed for only a moment, more than the light of the fire flashed across the aging woman's eyes. Aramis bowed his head slightly. Of that, I am sure. Now, to make matters worse. So, Lady Platt, how long has the Platt family been the true rulers of Avedon Hill? Gloria Platt smiled slightly.
Rulers. We have no desire for power, Sir Aramis. The Avedon family has played their part as well as any family could. Maybe not on the level of the Pairty royals, but well enough for a town such as this.
Aramis hoped that Gloria only invoked the Pairty name because she knew he had been a Ronic advisor to the royal family of Yew. I have some experience advising those in power, m'lady. I believe the Platt influence over the Avedon family has been far greater. Gloria smiled, but did not respond. I found some ledgers in your former office. They made for interesting reading.
Did they?
Aramis leaned forward. I do not care why or how so much gold flows into the Avedon coffers. I do not care that you and your family have managed to keep the wealth of this town a secret for, what, 400 years? All I care about is discovering who or what killed your daughter, and then returning her to her sacred home. Aramis let the statement hang in the air for a moment. Talk to me. I think you know you can trust me. Gloria could no longer meet the monk's eyes.
Trust is not something I possess at this point in my life, Sir Aramis. I am not so unlike you and your kind, Sir Monk. You advisers may serve the land, but primarily you do your best to control the actions of the powerful and wealthy across Cairn. My family has only sought to do the same, only on a much smaller stage.
I am not sure that the control you have over this town, the personal wealth your family has attained through the generations, merits a comparison to the work of the Aronic advisors. Gloria raised a hand from underneath her blanket and waved him off.
What I will tell you is that while what you have uncovered may help you in your investigation, I hope you understand that if you dig too deeply in an attempt to discover all the secrets of Avedon Hill, you may not be able to escape the hole that surrounds you.
Definitely one of the most polite threats I have ever received.
I think you should go now, Sir Aramis. I need my rest.
Aramis stood to take his leave. At the door, he turned back to face her. I must ask you one more question. Gloria guessed at the question before Aramis had the chance to ask it.
Lord Avedon is so worried because Greta's schedule book is missing.
And what is so important about her schedule book?
I believe it has something written in it. Nothing to do with her daily schedule.
Not to be outdone, Aramis connected the threads. The journal is the key to the ledgers. The letters, the numbers within the accounting books, they are not initials and payment amounts. They are a code that cannot be understood without Greta's journal. Without her book, the next house mistress will have no idea who owes and who is owed.
And how much, and when as well, Sir Monk.
Thank you.
Hi, everybody, and thanks for sticking around. I just wanted to cover some news items and babble a little bit about Balticon. And I'm going to start with Balticon. This was the first convention I've attended where I was on panels, talking about the podcasting and talking about the novel. The panels were great. I especially enjoyed the first panel I was on, which was Podiobooks 101. I was a little nervous about the Why Give It Away for Free panel I was on, because I was on with James Patrick Kelly and David Muldaur and Bill DeSmet. But Billy Flynn and Christiana Ellis were also on the panel, and Billy especially was referring to my podcast sometimes when he answered questions, so it did make me feel a little more comfortable, and overall I think the panel went great. But the most important thing about Balticon is seeing other podcasters and meeting people you've come to know, at least virtually, whether it's other podcasters or podcast listeners. The highlights for me for the weekend, first of all, I wanted to say the Singularity event that Earl Newton held for Stranger Things was wonderful. We learned that Stranger Things had been picked up for syndication on television, on the Illusion television network. And so this video podcast is going to be available on demand where this Illusion TV network is available. Basically, it means that Stranger Things is going to be available to 25 million homes, and just a great success story for Earl and for everybody that works on the Stranger Things video podcast. And if you want to learn more, and if you haven't watched Stranger Things, you need to go over to strangerthings.tv and learn more about that. Another big highlight for me was meeting Chris Lester, my nemesis. He walked in on Friday, threw on a Murder at Avedon Hill t-shirt, and I was wearing one of his t-shirts, and we faced each other, fist raised, and people took pictures. It was a lot of fun, and it was great to get to spend some time with Mr. Lester. And another highlight of the weekend was what I affectionately call Murr Day. Saturday, Murr had a live preview of The Takeover, which is her next podcast. We had a live reading from her next novel, Underground. And we had a live Geek Foo morning show after dark that night. So it was pretty much a Murr Day all the way around. But I think what I'll remember most about the weekend was the time I got to spend with Nathan Lowell. I've gotten to know Nate through our work over at the Podio Books community website. And my wife and I got to chat and break bread with Nate several times over the 4-day period. And it was good times. Lastly, of course, there was a time I got to spend with my mentor, T. Morris. And I'm going to save that till the end of the chatter. I've got more on that. But the next thing I did want to talk about is the contest I've got going on. If you visited the website, you've seen that I've changed a few things about the contest that I mentioned in the last episode, mainly to extend it to the end of June, and also to make it so I can actually track who has qualified for entry into the contest. So for those of you that missed it, I've got a contest that's going on till the end of June. If you leave a review at iTunes, or you have left a review at iTunes already in the past, you get an entry into the contest. Also, if you call into the Cairn line at 704-315-5884, you'll also get an entry into the contest. But no matter if you do one or both, you're not going to be officially entered into the contest until you send me an email at pgholyfield@murderatavedonhill.com. And be sure to have the subject line MAAH contest number 1. And just let me know that you've left a review or you placed a call to the Cairn line. And if you left a review, please put your name that you on iTunes so that I can identify that you left a review, and you'll be officially entered into the contest. And what are you going to get if you win the contest? You're going to get a t-shirt for sure, a t-shirt of your choice at the Spreadshirt store at pgholyfield.spreadshirt.com. And as mentioned on the website, if I get more than 20 reviews on iTunes during this contest, I'm going to be adding more prizes to the pool. Multiple winners, multiple prizes, and so on. So we'll have more on this in the next episode of the podcast, because I'll be able to gauge, you know, how the contest is going. And we'll have some, you know, some tied down numbers of winners and prizes by that time. And speaking of the next episode, on Sunday, June 15th, at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, I'm going to be doing a live reading of Chapter 23. I'll be doing this the same night that I'll be dropping Episode 24, which just happens to be Chapter 23. So, the same day I'm dropping the next episode, I'm going to be doing a live reading that night. The live reading will be done through the Ustream website, but I'll have the Ustream interface embedded into the Murder at Avedon Hill website, so again, I'll put out a little promo before June 15th with more details, but if you don't catch that and you want to attend on June 15th, 10 p.m. Eastern Time, go to the pgholyfield.com website and you'll see the Ustream interface and you'll be able to take part in the live reading. I'm going to take questions after the reading and hopefully make it a good event, so stay tuned for that. So lastly, we come back to my mentor, T. Morris. T. went a little crazy at Balticon during his live survival guide to writing fantasy. He basically called out every podcast novelist, claiming to be the uber nemesis to all. Well, his challenge did not go unanswered for long. My only promo for today's episode is the response that Pip Ballantyne, Chris Lester, and I put together with the help of J.C. Hutchins, Indiana Jim, and the one and only Leanne Mabry. Gonna play that here at the end to let T know exactly what we think of his challenge to us all, claiming to be our nemesis. Since he was the first podcast novelist, he thinks he has a little say in how good we're doing. So we got a little response for him. So, thanks for listening, and I will see you, or you will hear me, on the 15th. See you later.
On the Balticon Live Survival Guide to Writing Fantasy, T. Morris threw down the gauntlet, claiming to now be the uber nemesis of all other podcast novelists. Not one, but all. Calling himself the equivalent of Auric Goldfinger. Yeah, right.
T. Morris thinks he can attack us and get away with it.
So what do we do about it?
I've been thinking about this long and hard. We have to kill him.
Kill him? Isn't that a bit much?
That could work.
No, not him, Lester. His character.
His character's a bit dodgy as it is.
No, not T's character. His character in our podcast novels.
I don't know.
Why not? I can rewrite Murder at Avedon Hill. Hell, I can kill off Father Joris in the next episode.
I could rewrite Making the Cut. I don't really need Evan. Pip, you'll have to read more lines.
Guys.
Yeah, I wouldn't even include his death. Just a pool of blood and his holy symbol.
Oh, that's good.
Guys!
What?
T, he's Will.
So?
William Shakespeare? I sort of need him.
No, you don't.
It's Chasing the Bard.
Rewrite it.
Yeah, more Oberon and Mordant.
People like us better, anyway.
Sweet.
Oh, boy.
What will happen next? Will Father Joris become the next victim in Murder at Avedon Hill? Will Evan become permanently trapped in the body of his female alter ego? Will Shakespeare fall prey to the curse of T. Morris?
Be sure to visit pgholyfield.com, metamorecity.com, and chasingthebard.com to find out.
You've been listening to Murder at Avedon Hill, a podcast novel written and produced by P.G. Holyfield. please visit pgholyfield.com for more information on this novel and the author. Most of the music in this podcast generously provided by Shira Common through magnatune.com. Magnatune.com, they are not evil. Additional music generously provided by Kevin MacLeod through his website at incompetech.com. Be sure to check out Murder at Avedon Hill at podiobooks.com, and if you are so inclined, please post a review at iTunes, at Podcast Pickle, or at podiobooks.com. Audio comments about the podcast can be left on the Cairn line at 704-315-5884. Or go to pgholyfield.com and click on the Call Me button to leave comments. This podcast is copyright 2007-2008 by P.G. Holyfield and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 U.S. license.